Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on New FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. In the early 1990s, one of the most remarkable stories in English football was the incredible form of Oldham Athletic. In 1990, they reached the League Cup final and the FA Cup final the same year. The following year, they followed this up with promotion to the top division in 1991. My guest on the show today is Mike Keegan. Mike is the Sports News correspondent and Sports Agenda editor with the Daily Mail. Mike has recently written a book entitled This Is How It Feels, An English Football Miracle. The book tells the story of this incredible time for Oldham Athletic, and I'm delighted to say that Mike is joining me on the line. Mike, thanks so much for joining me today.
No problem. Pleasure to speak to you, Patrick.
So, Mike, writing this book, it must have been a lot of fun putting this book together, because that period in the early 90s was just a golden period for Oldham.
Yeah, it feels like a long time ago now, but that's exactly what it was. It was fun. I'm 43 now, so I was 1989 when the book started, so I was about 11, and These people that I'm writing about were my heroes. So to spend a few years basically meeting all my heroes and getting them to tell me their stories of this incredible time when, you know, we looked at, it sounds stupid now, but we looked at Man City, Man United, Liverpool, people like that as our equals. And yeah, given the state we're in now, it seems a million miles away. And it just felt important to try and kind of capture that time so that people know that it did actually happen.
And to put it in, for people that aren't familiar with the geography of England, Oldham, it's a small town. It's always been overshadowed by Manchester United and I suppose now Man City. So what they achieved, it was really, really incredible, and it must have been a brilliant feeling as for Oldham Athletic supporters to kind of say, listen, we've a club that we're really, really proud of, and we're up at the top table, and really, really, like, they were an established team for a few years in the early days of the Premier League.
Yeah, and we had absolutely no right to be. I mean, you're right, Oldham is, it's a decent sized town, it's 250,000 people live here, but we are right next to Manchester, so you can have a foot in Oldham and a foot in Manchester. So back when the book starts, 1982, when Joe Roll came in, and obviously he's the guy who made all this possible, you'd walk around Oldham Town Centre and you'd see City shirts, you'd see United shirts, you'd even see Leeds shirts. Leeds have quite a big following because it's only 30 miles over the Pennines, and obviously they were a big team at the time. So Oldham themselves, when Joe arrived, were only getting 4,000 fans, and as the book says, on his first day, he had a couple of strangers in his office that afternoon, and he thought they were directors that he'd not met yet. And it turned out that they were actually bailiffs sizing up his furniture for an unpaid tax bill. So for him to go from there, having to sell players to survive on gates of 4,000, to create this amazing team that, you know, played United twice in the FA Cup semi-final and were very, very unlucky, thanks to a dodgy refereeing decision, not to prevail, and to get to Wembley in the same season in the League Cup final, and then the next year to go one better and get us to the promised land. It's just an incredible achievement. And, you know, the crowds have gone from 4,000 to, they were getting 19,000 every week, Patrick, which is just unheard of. It's, you know, and it's something I don't think we'll ever see the likes of again.
And you mentioned Joe Ryle there, and he is central to the story. He just seemed to be the, you often hear people talking about a perfect manager for a club, and he seemed to be just a perfect fit for Oldham.
Yeah, Joe said to me, and Joe was absolutely magnificent in writing the book, because I think he got that, you know, I didn't want to write a book that was like, we played them and then we won and then we played them and drew. You know, you see loads of those and it can be a bit tedious. And I wanted to do something that captured the kind of behind the scenes and the shenanigans that they all got up to off the pitch, because they were quite a lively bunch. And Joe was amazing. I went to his house three or four times and spent hours there on each occasion. And Joe said, look, in football management, he stands and falls on recruitment. He said, you can have the greatest coaches in the world, but if the players can't do it, then there literally is no point. And during his own career, I mean, he played in the Premier League, well, the First Division for Everton. Mm. He played for England. You know, he's a big deal. And if he was playing now, who knows how much money he would have earned. But back then, obviously, things were different. He actually made more money buying and selling cars on the side than he did from playing football for Everton and England. And he said, Mike, I never used to play golf. Everybody else would go off when we had time on our own and play golf. I'd go to the auctions. He even had like a surplus, catalogue surplus business, buying, you know, bits of whatever he could get his hands on and selling them for a profit in a little shop that he had. So he kind of turned that eye for a bargain to buying footballers. You know, he'd get a car, spruce it up, take it to the auction and sell it on for a big profit. And that's exactly what he did with his players. You know, the likes of Dennis Irwin, who your listeners will know very well. Free transfer from Leeds, Dennis Irwin. Yeah, and he intercepts him because he was actually going to go to Chesterfield, manages to get in before Chesterfield brings him to Oldham, gets loads of games out of him, amazing player, and then sells him for a British record to Manchester United, you know, a guy that he got on a free transfer. So he says, you know, that background in buying and selling cars set him up for football management perfectly.
Mm. And you mentioned Dennis Irwin, who's just like, when we look across at the English football now, we're like, very few of our players are playing at the top, you know, top of the league. But back in the 90s, we had the likes of Dennis Irwin and Roy Keane. But you mentioned Dennis Irwin came from Leeds, and Joe Ryle had a real tendency of getting bargains from Leeds. And you tell a really, really funny story in the book, that so much so that when Oldham would make inquiries for Leeds players, they just spelled a rat and just said, oh no, we're not talking to you. Was there one he was looking to buy David Batty at one stage?
Yeah, that was it. So Billy Bremner was the manager at Leeds when all this happened, and I think with Billy things were not maybe as they should have been. So Leeds, I think under the manager in front of him, his name escapes me now, Leeds legend, but he brought in a load of young players, and basically the likes of John Sheridan, Scott Sellers, Dennis Irwin, and they were unfortunate not to get promoted. But Leeds sacked Eddie Gray was, and Leeds sacked him and brought Billy Bremner in. And Billy had gone to the other extreme, trying to bring in experienced players, and as a result there was kind of like this obscene cull of all these amazing young players that they had. And there was a coach at Leeds, a chap called Pete Gumby, who knew Joe Royle, and every now and then he'd phone Joe up and he'd say, Joe, you're not going to believe this, but we're letting Tommy Wright go, or we're letting Andy Ritchie go, or Dennis Irwin this time. So he had those three, and Andy Linegan, the old centre-half, who went on to play for Norwich, and I think he won the FA Cup, scored in the FA Cup final for Arsenal. But then Billy Bremner goes, and they replace him with Howard Wilkinson, who's obviously a bit more of a shrewd operator. And Joe decides he wants to go back to Leeds, and he says, Howard, he says, there's a boy in your reserves keeps getting sent off, David Batty. Howard says, yeah. He says, well, how much are you after? And I think Howard says, we want 500. And Joe starts off. He says, 500. He says, he's never played for your first team. And Howard says, well, Joe, I think that means we don't want to sell him then, doesn't it? And Howard had said, Joe, when I tell the directors here you're on the phone, they go out of the nearest available window. There were no more bargains to be had at Leeds, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that I think it really, really sums up the cuteness. And Oldham, it was a tight operation. Like the chairman, he ran a really, really tight ship, and so it was that ability to get bargains. And one other player I want to ask you about, Mike. You mentioned Dennis Irwin, but one other Irish player that was kind of central to Oldham's story was a player that I think he's overlooked. I was looking at his stats for Ireland. He's one of these unlucky players that he only played once for the Republic of Ireland, Mike Milligan. How important and how good of a player was he? I definitely think, just from, I didn't see an awful lot of him, but it seems that he definitely did deserve to play a lot more for Ireland.
Yeah, I never got that, Patrick. I never, you know, with my background, with a name like Keegan, you keep an eye out for the Irish results a lot, and I could never understand that, because obviously it was a great Irish team at the time, it's got to be said. But Millie was a midfield terrier who there was nobody like him for winning the ball back and giving it to another one of his own players. And I just thought, you know, Big Jack in charge at the time, that had been perfect for him, because he was all about functionality and aggression and drive and, you know, an incredible player who was integral to it all, really, for Oldham. He was a captain. I think he was only 24 years old. And he actually went to Everton at the end of the first season, the book talks about, for £1 million. So he was, I think his parents had both come over from Ireland. He was very proud of it. And he will tell you more than anybody else that he was both upset and mystified to have only played once for them.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think Jack Charlton was a very legendary figure, as you can imagine, over here, but he was very set on his ways. And I think if when he had a settled team, he kind of probably, you know, Mike probably just didn't fit in, which was quite unfortunate for him. And
Look, Jack did what Jack did, and, you know, I don't know whether we'll ever see that repeated, unfortunately. So you can totally understand that. He's an acquired taste, Millie, a lovely guy. I met him for lunch, and it's when you're writing a book, you always go out and you're thinking, am I going to get enough information? Are these people going to be forthright? Are they going to tell me enough stories? I think I had to shut him up. I think we were there for about 4 hours. I've never known anything like it. So he was really valuable when writing the book, and told me some great tales.
Yeah, and that was the thing. It really, really comes across. And I just was reading the book. Some of the stories are hilarious. Like, it really, really, like, it was, you know, there was a drinks culture there. It was all to do with team bonding. So I don't know whether football nowadays, when it's so sports science related, whether they have as much kind of times like that. But that really was a thing that kind of really, really helped the club. And there was a really, really strong bond within the club.
Yeah, well, they used to have what they called the Tuesday Club. So back in the day, they never played on Wednesdays. And the Tuesday Club was basically after training, because they'd have Wednesday off. They'd all meet at 12 o'clock and they'd go out, and that'd be them for 12 hours at the pub. And John Haworth, who was the keeper, he came from Ipswich, and he said, you know, Ipswich, most people had played golf or something like that. You get a couple who would go out for a couple of beers. At Oldham, the Tuesday Club, there'd be 17 of them stood at the pub at 12 o'clock, and that'd be them. They'd be out for the day, and some of the stories, a bit of police involvement, and nothing too bad. Joe said, look, you know, they were a bit rum, but they weren't Wimbledon. And he said, I didn't know where they were on Tuesday afternoons very often, but I always knew where they were when they needed to be in training, and they certainly did on a Saturday afternoon. And I think, yeah, it was a different time when players would drink, and I think, you know, the game has moved on. Some would say, you know, we could do with a little bit more of that kind of team camaraderie back. But Willie Donaghy, Joe's number two, who would take the training sessions, kind of balanced that out, because he was incredibly advanced. His pressing game, he'd bring in ballet dancing coach. He'd have them playing table tennis without a ball. He was all about movement and kinetics, and he'd have aerobics instructors coming in, and he hated it. Willie told me, you know, he really didn't like the players going out on Tuesday, but because of the team spirit and the bond that forged, it was actually worthwhile in the end.
And I Oldham now, Mike, before I kind of wrap up, we're recording this on Monday, so it's prior user. Oldham are playing Tranmere tomorrow, and currently in the relegation zone, and it'd be incredible if Oldham go down into the non-league. What is the feeling around the supporters now? Is there pessimism that they might face the trapdoor this year, or what is the view?
Yeah, I think Patrick, we could do another show and just fill it with the misery that we've had over the past few years. We were taken over in 2018 by a Dubai-based Moroccan agent, a chap called Abdallah Lems again, and it's just been nothing but a car crash since. I think we've had 9-10 managers in that period. The current manager that we've got is a Tunisian chap who was brought in to take the youth team as the interim head coach. Nobody will be surprised if he gets the job full-time. Paul Scholes came in and left pretty quickly. We had a boyhood fan, Pete Wild, really nice guy in charge of the team, and he left to go and manage Halifax in non-league. Things are that bad. So we all genuinely think that we will be heading out of the league. We'll be the first team to play in the Premier League to go out of the Football League. There are protests nearly every week trying to get these people out of the club, and the future has never looked worse, I don't think. We hope and we pray that someone can come in and, with a few quid and get them out, and, you know, not bring the good times back that I wrote about. Nobody's stupid enough or you know, to think that we can get back into the Premier League. All we want is just a team that's run properly, that's in the league, that we can all get behind. And, you know, we've had loads of French trialists brought in, loads of players in the lower leagues of France. It's a catalogue of misery. I mean, you can Google it. There's been plenty written about it. But, you know, I've not got any kids yet. But if I do have kids, then I'd be very surprised if I get to take them to watch Oldham.
Which is a real pity. And what is, it's really, really sad. Like, I read stories about, I remember reading about Blackpool and clubs like this, great traditions, and not so long ago in the Premier League, and even the likes of, you know, the Oldham, who were a great team in the 90s. What is the, is there any moves? It just looks bad ownership and someone that is not the interest of the club at heart. Is there any advances, any in terms of any movement in terms of getting new ownership there, or is the current regime just hanging in there?
Yeah, no, it's a disaster. And to be fair to them, I wouldn't say it's not through having the club's best interest at heart, but just think they're grossly incompetent, and they've shown that time and time again. It's just not working. The issue we've got is that the previous owners separated the land, and the stadium and all the land around it, because there's quite a lot of land at Boundary Park, they separated that from the club into a private company. So the current owner doesn't own anything other than the football club. So he wants a certain amount for that, and then you'd have to pay, I think it's £6 million for the land and everything else around it. It's just not viable, Patrick. Nobody's going to pay that. It's not worth it. The guy needs to cut his losses and just say, look, I've tried, it's not worked. But from what I'm hearing, he just won't do that. So meantime, he has now launched a legal battle against the previous owners, saying that it's wrong and that he should own the land and the state. And that's clearly, in my eyes, not going to go anywhere. Just going to waste time, and it's just going to make it, if there is a knight in shining armour, it's just going to make it even more difficult. And then if we do go out of the league, then it's even less of a viable proposition. So it's just a perfect storm, really, that I think we'll see the end of the football club.
Well, your book covers a time when things were better for Oldham. This is how it feels, an English football miracle. It's available now. Really crack and read, really, as you say, it's not a blow by blow account, which I think adds to the book. It's just really, really well put together. Mike, thanks a million for joining us. Good luck for Oldham for the rest of the season. I know big game against Tranmere on Tuesday night, so hopefully they might hold on there in the Football League. Mike, thanks again for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Patrick. Cheers.